Hi, everybody. This is Joanne with Read Science. I'm Science Goddess on Twitter. And naturally, I am joined by Jeff Schomeyer, my co-host, and gosh, we've known each other a long time, Jeff, and only have met once in person. Once in person.
Dan, it doesn't really matter, does it?
No, not anymore, right? So, but our love of popular science books brought us together. So, and we are here today with Kristi Eschwanden. I didn't ask you how to say your last name, so I hope I got that right.
You did.
Yay. So Kristi Eschwanden is the author of Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. And as I just said before we went live, I felt even if you're not an athlete, there's good information in here. Not the least of which is science is not always the best way to study recovery, is it? It's very hard to make a good study. So, so Kristi is the, until recently, was the lead science writer at 538 and a former health columnist for the Washington Post, a finalist for the National Magazine Award. Her writing has appeared in Outside, Discover, Smithsonian, and O, the Oprah Magazine. She was a high school state champion in the 1600 meter run, a national collegiate cycle champion, and an elite cross country skier with Team Rossignol. Did I say that right?
You did.
Hey, she lives and occasionally still races in Western Colorado. Thanks, Kristi, for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, so it's great because we get to talk about how do we apply science to athletics and performance and things like that. We spoke with Alex Hutchinson a few months ago for his great book, Endure, right, Jeff?
Yeah, and you've foreshadowed where I want to start because the subject of the book, which I was surprised was an entire book, let alone a really fascinating book, so congratulations from me on that, is recovery, that necessary period of rest and adaptation that comes after training and working at being an athlete. And after about the first 60 pages, even, it didn't take me very long, I made a note to myself because I thought, we're going to talk about these various recovery things and maybe you're going to debunk some of these so-called facts and this and that. And that turns up, but I was so happy to see your commitment that what you were really talking about was what science, and we mean real science here, has to say about all of the things that swirl around recovery and what athletes believe and want to do to do better. And that there is a fair amount to say, and that it's really hard. And I wondered then, to get a handle on that, if we could start by recounting your story of your experiment with the beer and what you learned about how hard it is to get the science questions right.
Sure. So I should say I'm really pleased to hear what you were just saying about the book because, you know, even though it looks like a book about sports, it's really fundamentally a book about science and the scientific method. And I've been, a lot of the writing I've done in recent years, particularly at 538, has been sort of addressing how we talk about science and how we use it and sort of what our expectations of science are. And I think one of the things that I'm sort of arguing in the book, as I have also done in some of my 538 work, is that sometimes we expect too much of science and we sort of think of science as this magic wand that turns everything it touches into truth, when in fact, science is really a process. It's not an answer. It's a process of uncertainty reduction. And there's always going to be some uncertainty sort of encased in science and the answers that we get with science. And this is a feature of science. It's not something that's showing that it's wrong or it's a bad way of doing things. In fact, I would say that science is the most powerful tool we have for understanding the world. And so that's sort of the context here. And so, okay, so how am I going to explain all of this to my, you know, sports jock audience here with this book? And I want to say too that I hope that this book is not just for elite athletes or even for serious athletes. I think it's for anyone who has ever exercised or is interested in exercise. And it's interesting. I have gotten feedback now from readers, both both elite people, Olympians who love the book, but also from people who are saying, you know, I'm just trying to get started with exercise and this has been really helpful. So that's been really pleasing to me.
My own enthusiasm for exercise is probably at the minimal end of your audience. And I still found plenty to interest me and guide me and also tell me about science. But okay.
I was happy to learn about DOMS. I'm like, so that's why after all those squats, I'm dying the next day or 2 days later, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And DOMS is delayed onset muscle soreness. It's that soreness that you get that doesn't happen right away, which makes it a little bit mysterious and interesting.
Huh? Yeah, and that you described it exactly. You know, it's you could describe it, the muscles under tension while they're flexed.
Yeah, so it is particularly acute. The best way, so when scientists want to research DOMS, late onset muscle soreness, in the lab, they make people run downhill, or sometimes they'll make them like stand on, kind of do like reverse box jumps. So they'll stand up high and jump down. And so what makes DOMS so acute usually is when your muscle's contracting while it's lengthening. Yeah. So this is like, if you can imagine doing a barbell, you know, a lift like this, it's not the lifting part, it's the letting it down part where your arm is, the muscle is extending while it's also contracting. That is the stuff of, you know, that makes DOMS particularly bad. And so running downhill is a great way to induce DOMS if that's what you're trying to do.
I can do without that.
I still want to hear about the beer experiment. Because it's where you start the book, which is a good place. And I'm also wondering if that's close to where you began this this investigation of science.
Yeah, it is. So I very deliberately began the book with the beer study, and I'll get to the beer study in a second, but for all of the reasons that we were just talking about, I really wanted to lay the groundwork for readers about the scientific process and what we can and can't expect of it, and why, you know, answers that are produced by studies may not always be reliable. And so the beer study really took root. Sort of describe, I have been in this running race, which I've been dumb enough to do multiple times. I think I'm going on like six times now. But this race that's a very, very extremely steep. It begins by climbing 2,000 feet in 2 miles, and then it gets to the top of this little peak, and then you drop down the other side, and it's just about as steep on the way down. And the first time I did this race, I literally could not walk the next day. I had so much delayed onset muscle soreness. It was really terrible, and I hadn't really properly. Now I know that if I'm going to do this race, which I do, that I need to do some preparation and do some hard downhill running in advance, so that this is making use of something called the repeat bout effect. And so you probably notice that if you start going to the gym and lifting weights, you always get the most sore after the first time. And this is because it's a new and novel thing. You're causing some micro damage to the muscles. And so what happens is your body goes in and there's this repair process that takes place that not only repairs the damage that was done, but sort of reinforces the muscles a little bit and prepares them for the next bout. And that's why the second or third bout, you will not get as sore as you do the first time.
Anyway, is all part of the adaptation, right?
Right. That's so part of the adaptation. Yeah. And that's part of the recovery process. So that's the important stuff. You know, you do not get better, faster, stronger during the training itself. Mm-hmm. It's all of the stuff that's happening during the recovery period. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes recovery so crucial and so important. So I'm at this race. I've just finished. The finish line of this race is actually a fire pit. You have to jump over the fire. And then there's a reward at the end. There's always a refreshing cold beer in the coolers, you know, also some food. They often have some bratwurst and some other stuff. But anyway, so I'm standing around, you know, it's morning. Pretty warm spring morning, drinking a refreshing cold beer, thinking this tastes really great, but you know, is it possible that this is harming my recovery? You know, alcohol is, it's sort of a little bit like coffee, I think, in that it's mind altering and very pleasant. And so, you know, we have this like sneaking suspicion that it must be bad for us, even though we sort of secretly hope that it's good for us. And so that was sort of the origin of my query here. So I thought, okay, this should be, you know, pretty straightforward. I went to the scientific literature, you know, as a science journalist by vocation, that's sort of what I do. So I queried the scientific literature, and I found that there was some research on alcohol and exercise, but most of it was, interestingly enough, there was studies that actually looked at people that were consuming alcohol during exercise, which that was definitely not what I was looking at. You know, that was not the question that I was trying to answer. are also studies mostly in rugby players for some reason, although also some strength athletes, but where here they were giving people, you know, incredible amounts of alcohol. So we're talking like 6 or 7 or 8 beers after a bout of exercise. And I the scenario I'm interested in is, you know, one beer. So it wasn't really answering my question. So I trained as a biologist back in college. I used to do research full time, and so, but I'm still kind of an experimentalist at heart. And I decided, okay, the thing to do here is to do my own experiment. So I teamed with some local researchers, got a little bit of money from Runner's World. I was writing for quite a bit at the time. It was actually not an expensive study, although it did require, you know, quite a bit of time and sort of lab resources in terms of getting people into the lab. And so we designed a study to try and look at this question. And this seems like a really simple, straightforward question, right? Does beer impair recovery from a hard run? And that seems pretty easy. But what I found out while doing the study is that it was anything but easy, and that the answers that we got, although they were very enticing, did not feel reliable to me. And so I was not only part of the planning of this study, so I was heavily involved in the planning of the study and sort of deciding the design and all that. Obviously, the researchers sort of had the final word, and we had to get institutional review board approval and all of that. And so, you know, I was just sort of a participant. I wasn't the, you know, the PI or anything like that. But I was also a participant, and that was important because there were some insights that I gleaned as a participant of the study that I think would have been somewhat invisible to me as just an organizer. And one of them was that the test that we were using to measure recovery, it turned out that as a participant, I realized that it was a pretty lousy measure of the thing that we were really caring about. And this is a really important concept, and I think it goes throughout science, and that is, you know, you really need to make sure that you're measuring the right things. And it's very easy to find things that are measurable and find differences, and you can reach all kinds of conclusions, but you really have to make sure, take a step back and ask, you know, are we measuring the right things? Is this really a good way of understanding or measuring the thing that we care about? And so here, the thing that I cared about, you know, the scenario here is I do a race like the one that I did, or I do oftentimes I'll go running with friends. We'll do a pretty hard run and have a beer afterwards, usually some food. And, you know, am I going to feel lousy the next day? Am I going to be less able to do a nice run or bike ride, whatever it is that I'm going to do the next day? Like, is that going to be impaired? But it turned out that this study, or this test that we used in our study, didn't seem like a good measure of it. And the test that we used was one that was, we actually never really gave it a second thought because it's a very established test. It's used throughout the scientific career. It's sort of a very standard test. And so never even thought about, you know, second guessing it. But it was something called a run to exhaustion. So you're basically put on a treadmill at a speed that's pretty hard, but not all out. And then you just have to keep going as long as you can. Well, this is unlike any sort of real thing that you do in real life. You know, this isn't like going out for a hard run that has an ending. And it really, you know, and I, after the study was over, we had our results, I sort of debriefed with all of the other participants, and it was sort of a pretty universal feeling that we all felt like at some point this just became sort of a test of how committed are you to the study, you know, of which we are all volunteering our time. It's sort of for the good of science, but nothing else. None of us are being paid for it. We're, you know, giving up a whole weekend in the service of science here. And at some point you're just sort of uncomfortable and bored, and okay, how committed are you? And you know, of course it's also measuring, you know, that is a part of the recovery process too. I'll just point out how you're feeling and all of that. But in the end, it did not feel like a good measure of the thing that we really cared about. And so that was sort of one important insight here. And that is that just because you can find a difference and you can measure it doesn't mean that it's the right thing. And this is something I found again and again, looking at some of these recovery modalities. So often, you know, the proponents could point to studies and say, oh, look, you know, scientifically proven, but you sort of look at the study and it's like, well, yeah, and there are other problems too. Our study was very small, only 10 participants, which, you know, for a clinical medicine study, that would be laughable, even like probably publishable anywhere. But in sports science, that kind of sample size is very common. And that's problematic because, you know, samples that small tend to, you know, they're more likely to lead to misleading results that don't stand up over time.
Well, it's a very illuminating story too for setting stage. I love the aphorism that you came up with of saying that just because you can measure it doesn't mean it's answering your questions.
Yeah.
And in the way that I think science typically progresses, you finished the study and the first thing you did was all these questions started coming up, and they were better questions than you started out with. And
yeah.
So it seems to me like very often science progresses by always just finding better questions to try to get closer to an answer. And the hard part is usually in the questions.
That's right. And science is iterative, and that's how it should work. Like, this is, I wanted to say, this is science working. It's not a sign mm-hmm. that science is broken, or that, you know, I actually wrote a story for 538 a few years ago. The headline was "Science Isn't Broken." It's the subtitle was something like, "It's just a hell of a lot harder than we give it credit for." And I think that this beer study really illustrates that, you know, this was a group of well-meaning researchers doing everything right, not trying to game the system or anything like that. Yeah. And we didn't get, I just realized I didn't say what the results were, which were that we found these really, I mean, to me, they're very enticing. Mm-hmm. The results showed that beer was for women. It seemed to be performance enhancing. So women that drank some beer after their run performed better the next day. So it seemed to be not just not hurting recovery, but enhancing it. Whereas for men, it was exactly the opposite. And in the same sort of direction, it was like a 20 or 22% difference both ways. But, you know, again, looking at this, we had a few outliers in each sample that probably mm-hmm. really skewed those results. And we had, you know, we did find one significant p-value where, you know, if you're using p-value as sort of a measure of whether something is reliable or not, which, by the way, is a terrible thing to do mm-hmm. and not to use, but that is like so often how it is used in science. Yeah, we had sort of license to say that we found this statistically significant difference where beer was great for women. Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, I did not, I really wanted to believe. I still want to believe this result. But, you know, it was hard to actually believe that it was something real. And I'll just say, the next step, I think, is to follow up. And so I'm actually talking to the folks who did the study, and we're looking into, we're planning to do another study this summer that will be not just a replication, it will sort of take the next step. So it will, right. you know, given some thought into, you know, not just the run to exhaustion, we'll use a different test, but also thinking about some other factors that, you know, I think
yeah.
the important question to do here when you get your results is to say, okay, this is interesting. How could they be wrong? And what are the ways in which we may have been misled? What are the things that we need to account for, you know, in the next iteration of this? And so that's what we're working on. In fact, we're having a meeting in about a week
yeah.
to discuss
and once, this. Once you got to those results,
yeah.
whatever they were, the way you reacted to them, the way you reacted to them, as a scientist looking at these things, is very different from the way the sports drink marketer would treat these things and stuff. So that's such a gorgeous example. And you did do that, I think, very well throughout the whole book of showing how the science was working and how real science approaches this and how it's usually a work in progress. And the whole crux of looking more carefully at the questions you've asked versus the answers that you've gotten, whether that's really answering your questions.
Yeah.
I enjoyed all those examples rather than exposition really clarified a lot of those things, I thought.
Right. And I liked it's the same with Alex Hutchison's book Endure. A lot mm-hmm. of the answers are, well, it depends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and that just, I'm a biologist, and it just, you know, I don't know how many times I have to explain, well, biology is really a movable thing.
Yeah.
One yeah. day you may be at your peak anyway, because you had good nutrition 2 days ago, or you slept, or yeah. you know, so on any given day, you know, this yeah. is where you get the large sample size.
Wow. Yeah, and I think that raises another important issue, and that is that, you know, we're studying, when you're looking at human physiology, there are so many variables. These are very mm-hmm. complex systems. And it turns out it's extremely difficult to isolate, you know, particular things. So you may want to be looking at some intervention that you're doing, and particularly when it's something like, you know, feeding a particular food, let's say, or doing, you know, some particular training intervention. There are so many other factors at play. So you may really do your best to try and make the differences between your groups just this one thing. But, you know, we're so highly variable, and so many of these measures and things that are used in these tests are physiological measures that have natural variation already. And it's mm-hmm. it can be very difficult to tease those out and to really separate the signal from the noise.
But
and I think you did a good job sort of trying to emphasize this. Yes, but maybe not. Or you know, like the it depends was just the general sense I got. It really
That's
depends.
That's a good catch-all, you know, answer to any scientific question, right?
Yeah, but there was, I don't know about whether I want to anticipate the end of the book or something or your conclusions, but for the reader who might be the sports enthusiast looking for some clues, and now we don't want to leave them with the impression that, Christy has just gone through and say, well, no, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, and you're wasting your time doing that. There were questions, there were answers, there were ways to understand it, but by the time you got to the end, you found that even if science didn't have the advice that we thought perhaps it had, that doesn't mean that there isn't some value in understanding what's going on and using some of these things, just that they may serve different purposes as well. And I thought that was a very useful.
Right. I actually really like that towards the end of the book to say, you know, well, okay, so maybe this ice bath or these compression boots aren't actually doing anything, but you know, if in your mind they're doing something or you just feel good doing them, then it's doing something, right? It's so complicated.
I have it right.
Yeah,
I have it right here, Joanne, that different recovery modalities can make you feel better, provide ritual for taking care of yourself, and formalize a way to stop and focus on resting. And those are no small things for what you've shown us is the importance of resting. As recovery, right?
Yeah. And I think we're sort of at a cultural moment where we've just gotten really bad at its most basic level. Recovery is rest, it's relaxation. And this is something that we're not so good at these days. And so everyone's looking, you know, they're reaching for the app or the product that they can buy or the thing, you know, the weird thing that they can do. And we've sort of been, you know, this marketing is all being aimed at us, you know, to convince us that one weird trick away from our optimal selves. And so much of this stuff really turns on this anxiety of that people have of, you know, I call it FOMO or fear of missing out. It's often called, you know, this idea that, well, your competition, you know, the other guy is doing this thing that's giving some advantage, or if you're not doing this, you're missing out. And it these products in particular really trade on that anxiety and this feeling that people have that like maybe they're not doing things right and there's something they could be doing better. And so that's really such a huge part of this. And I think another big takeaway from the book is that so much of the science that's sort of being told about these things is really not science being done in the service of understanding things and seeking truth, but really it's marketing exercises. So you have to be really careful and look at how the science is presented. And is this something, you know, someone did a study to find something they could measure to like show benefit to their product, or is it something that's really designed and carried out in a way that's you know, embracing some of this uncertainty that's inherent in it? And is that being disclosed? Because, you know, when things are being presented as sort of, well, proven by science, oftentimes that's sort of a red flag that it's being oversold.
Did it surprise you to come to the conclusion that you did, that the science in some sense, when you've considered all of these things, is reassuring you that that rest and some fairly straightforward ideas seem to be the ones that are doing the most, and that we should just have confidence that nature knows the way to go?
Yeah, I mean, I did have an expectation that there would be more things that were sort of proven by science, or that I think I did expect to have more sort of scientific tricks that had been revealed by science, right? Like this one weird thing. Like there really weren't those one weird thing. I mean, the one weird thing that you can do to enhance recovery is sleep. And that's something that's not really a weird trick, right?
That's
something
weird.
We all know and like whatever. So but I will say I was a little bit concerned because you're right, although there's a lot of debunking in the book, I definitely don't come down on it. There's also a lot of stuff that works, and a lot of these things, a lot of the most popular things, I really do conclude that they really do work, but in so many cases, they're working by different mechanisms than the ones that are sort of being sold with the veneer of science. And so that was kind of, I think that was a little bit surprising to me as well, that it was like, okay, so the science is pseudoscience in a lot of cases, and yet I actually feel like this thing is still working, and it's working via a different mechanism. But I think that we're just really at a moment where people have been convinced also that they can't trust their bodies and that they need these experts swooping in to give them advice and tell them things. I mean, at the most basic level, I think there's a whole chapter in the about hydration and how science and this whole concept of measuring the wrong thing really led us astray. And it's gotten to a situation where we actually have people dying now, like literally dying.
Drinking from too much plain
drinking
water.
Too much fluid.
But
during
not from dehydration.
No
one has ever known to have died from dehydration, but hypoglycemia, they have.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I didn't find a single case of someone dying of dehydration in a marathon or in a sporting event, but you have people now dying of hyponatremia or water intoxication, it's also called, where people are consuming too much fluids. And they're doing this because they've been told that they can't trust their bodies. They can't trust their thirst. By the time you're thirsty, it's too late. And this is just, you know, what I found out is that that's just nonsense. It's not wrong. Scientific. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there trying to sell you things. And, you know, it's kind of astounding right now. Sometimes there are a couple of times while writing this book where I just sort of imagine myself going back 50 years and like finding some experts and say, you're not going to believe this, but 50 years in the future, people are going to be paying money for water and bottles and they're going to be convinced that they have to take it everywhere. And because this is just, I mean, when you really think about it, it's so ludicrous. And yet that's where we're at right now. And people are convinced. I mean, I challenge you to go anywhere today where people aren't carrying water bottles around, where you aren't constantly being handed water. And, you know, look, it's important to drink water. And I'm not against hydration. And I certainly am not saying that hydration isn't important. But we've really been sold this concept of it that just isn't scientific. But I think that the interesting thing to me is that sort of underlying these new messages and the marketing messages around hydration is that you can't trust your body. You need us experts to fill you in, and you need special products, and you can't do the sort of normal, easy thing, which would be drinking some water at your convenience and to your thirst. But instead, you know, you need to buy this chart that tells you, I mean, people have alarms now that they will set on their sports watches or phones to tell them to drink. And yeah, this is just ridiculous.
And not only what useless, but can be counterproductive. But you're talking about the changes, and you know I'm the old one, so I'm thinking about how it used to be. People always say "bye, have a nice day," and now usually it's "goodbye, stay hydrated," or something which seems a little odd. But then one more big observation I thought when I got to the end of the book was we've had decades of the public coming to understand a little bit more about medical research and the importance of double-blind studies and placebos. And you talked a lot about interesting placebos, but the point that I thought was interesting was, in the end, the placebo effect, which we've, you know, a lot of people have heard of now, can have positive effects. So don't feel too stupid, but don't go overboard with it, right? That it was surprising that as long as if it makes you feel good, it may be doing some good because it's helping you to rest and focus on some repair activities.
Yeah, that's right. And I have a whole chapter in the book about placebos. And I sort of come out, I guess I would say I'm pro placebo, and I'm not at all. I want to be really clear. I am totally against people wasting money on ineffective things. I'm against people getting suckered into believing that things that don't work do. But at the same time, I interview a guy in the book and talk about him who prefers to call it the expectation effect. And I think that that's a better way of describing it. Because the placebo effect, we so often think of it as, it's just the placebo effect, so therefore it's not real. But the placebo effect is real, and these are real effects. What's different is just where, the mechanism is coming from and what's going on. And so, if you're interested in recovery and you're wanting to enhance your recovery and to focus on your recovery, then the placebo is your friend. Like, it's okay. It doesn't matter. It doesn't need to be coming from infrared radiation to get that. It can be coming from your expectation. And our expectations can actually exert a very heavy influence on how we actually experience something. And so DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness, is a great example of this. So if I'm doing something that I expect will reduce my DOMS, then, you know, that next day or that, that time when I will expect to be really sore, that expectation that I will feel less sore can actually alter my actual experience of that soreness. And so I may end up really feeling as though that soreness is less just because that's how I expect to feel.
Right. So whether it's a foam roller or stretching, which, you know, of course, right. I grew up in a time where it's like stretch before, stretch after. You know, and then over years, you start saying, oh, no, we want an active warm up and an active recovery. And we want, you know, so there are fads in all of the.
When I was a high school runner, we would I remember this so vividly. Before every practice we had, it was very ritualized. We had this whole routine of stretching that we would do. In fact, I was team captain and I was, me and the other team captain would be leading the group and we were doing this stretch and then that stretch. And it was probably about 15 minutes worth of just static stretching like we used to do. And that's just what we did. And we thought it was good. And I can't even recall. I mean, I think we were supposed to do it because it was, you know, part of the warm up and maybe we'd be less sore, but it just, you know, we never really questioned it. It was part of what we were doing.
That's what you did at the time. So actually, this is where I will jump in and talk a little bit about my son who has been ultra marathoning.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
It's amazing because in high school he did nothing. You know, he goes to Colorado for grad school, and suddenly, you know, the great outdoors calls and join us. And he starts trail running. Then he moved to California, still, you know, trail running. So. What amazed me, so I went to my very first ultra marathon, and as sort of as a crew where you are not officially one of the people working with the thing, but you're there for your person. And
I have to tell you, I wrote a whole story. You should look this up because I think you'd enjoy it. For Runner's World a few years ago, I paced a friend of mine at the 100-mile Wasatch 100 ultra race. But it's interesting that, but the story is really about this whole concept of pacing and what pacers do, and this dilemma of watching your runner and they go through so much suffering and pain, and how do you sort of, you know, you don't want to hurt them but you want them to finish, and
you're encouraging them to go. So luckily I am not a pacer, so I think at this particular race it was 100k, he did not have a pacer, but I know he often does. And but I was amazed. I will tell you this. I was amazed at how some of them just would come. Some of these runners would just come through the aid station looking fresh as a daisy. I'm like, who are you? Like, I cannot believe this. And even my son, you know, he had like a salt on his face, you know, but he, you know, he didn't look especially tired. And I was like, this is. Wow, you know, so that I'm sure has a lot to do with training. But I guess my point is here, he's a fan of your writing at 538. So he's going to have to look harder to find your what you're producing. But he did try the ice bath after you wrote about ice baths. And he even goes, oh, I just saw her article about Gatorade. And so things like that. So Jeff, I will tell you, there is something you should never have. So Jeff, you're diabetic, right? So there's this substance that these runners take called goo, which is this concentrated glucose.
To
keep their calories up while they're running for 10 hours or whatever it is.
That's the sort of thing I tend to avoid, except in extreme conditions.
Well, and Ben, I can tell you that those goos, so I've consumed those too. The dilemma when you're doing a long event like that, and this is really, we're talking marathons or ultra marathons. This is nothing
you'd ever want.
Not a 5K, probably not even a half marathon, but you know, this is concentrated. You need, at some point, you're depleting the glycogen in your muscles. And so you need to refuel. And this is what keeps your performance up. This is what allows people to come in looking fresh as a daisy.
Yes.
Right? In those ultra marathons, probably the number one challenge actually is nutrition, and not just getting those calories in and all that, but people will, you know, it's a challenge. Your body's working so hard. And so people tend to have a lot of gastrointestinal issues. And sometimes that food that seemed great in training, now that you're in the race and maybe you're going a little bit harder or something, you know, now your stomach's upset and people are not handling
things well. Can't keep your food down or in.
You need to get those calories in so you can continue exercising. But it's also a challenge to do that. And, you know, you're using all your bloods and all the muscles, you know, tends to shut down the gastrointestinal system a little bit. So sort of that's a challenge too. So yeah, that nutrition aspect is a huge challenge for people doing the ultra endurance events.
Right. And I saw you did have a chapter about a lot of things like power bars and Clif bars and, you know, things like that. So these nutrition bars.
Yeah.
Which you can consume during a race, before a race, after a race, whatever, but in the hopes that you are getting some optimal level of not just calories, but proteins, fats, and restorative things. So actually, I wanted to ask, to me, the most interesting and enlightening chapter was about overtraining. I can, you know, in my mind, I could see, oh, I overtrained this week and I really should take it easy next week. I did not know about people who overtrained for years and then suddenly they're wiped out. They can't function for months, maybe years, maybe ever. That was very fascinating. And I'd love to hear you talk about that some more.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And it's actually pretty common among particularly endurance athletes or any kind of athlete that's doing a lot of training sort of regularly, chronically. And so much of this derives from, I think so many athletes in these situations are just by nature very driven. And so there's this idea that more is better and the way to get better is to do more. When in fact, you know, one of the things that really became apparent to me researching this book is that you really, the key with training is you want to do sort of the minimum amount of training that will get you the adaptations that you're looking for and that will get you the fitness that you're looking for. Because going beyond that, you're not benefiting if you're not able to recover from that extra training. And what ends up happening with people who are overtrained is they're sort of outpacing their body's ability to recover from that training. And at some point, things just break down. It's like, you know, it's like a house that's repeatedly battered by storms. And if you can't keep, you know, shuttering the windows and keeping the weather out, at some point the house falls over. And that's sort of what happens with overtraining. And in some cases, I mean, it's almost always at least season ending for an athlete, but in some cases it can be career ending. And I talk about in the book, an elite marathoner who sort of had this happen to him. But one thing that was really interesting to me is that overtraining isn't just something that happens in elite athletes. And in fact, it may even be as common or more of a problem in people who are, so there's sort of a kind of athlete who's a driven professional who's doing, say, Ironmans or marathons or doing some sort of sport activity at a pretty serious level on top of their professional life. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, the thing that I think is easy to lose sight of is that to our bodies, stress is stress, whether it's coming from exercise or from the other things in our lives. And so what happens is you have people who have very stressful lives already. And in some cases, you know, the exercise may be their way of unwinding, and exercise can be a very powerful stress reducer. It can be a great way of coping with those things. But when you're exercising hard and doing, you know, really training at higher levels, it's also, it is a strain on your body as well. And so what can happen is you have all of these stresses. So you have someone who's working sort of a stressful job, who's then using their spare time to train hard and sort of stress their body even more. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, where is the recovery happening? And where is that unwinding happening? And where is that rejuvenation and relaxation happening if every single hour of every day is you know, programmed and planned and involving some stress related thing. So
yeah, I thought that was a really good point. These other stresses, or even as an individual, how do you handle stress?
Yes, exactly. Right. You know, exactly.
My friend asked my son after the marathon. So, you know, he's wanting to run 100 miles next. He's already signed up.
And which one is he doing?
It's in Lake Tahoe in July, and he told me the name. Oh, it's not Western States. That is his ultimate goal.
Yeah.
Of course, I think that's all their goals. But so my friend said, so to train for that, do you run 75 miles? He goes, oh, no. It's really bad for your body running this far. So, you know, so he says, no, you run, you know, your normal training during the week, maybe a 50-miler on occasion, and then you just – trust that you're going to keep going for 100 miles, right? Over 20 hours, or, you know, if you're good, 15 hours, and 36 hours if you're not so good, right? So,
is that really true, though? I mean, it sounds like there's some nonlinear phenomena involved with these stressors and the overtraining thing, where it's like, 10 miles, 20 miles, maybe these 30 miles, maybe they do use the same strategies for sustaining you through that. But it sounds also like there's some point, maybe it's different for everyone, where beyond that, those strategies don't work and you have to have prepared differently or done something different, but maybe not. See, I don't know about this.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people who start these races don't finish. There's a lot of attrition. So it's true. And they're difficult. I haven't done one and I don't think that I will. It is hard on your body. And I'm sort of at an age now too, now that I'm over 40, I'm a little bit, I have to say I'm emphasizing recovery a lot more than I used to. But also for the enjoyment, I find that, you know, I can get as much pleasure out of running 6 miles as I can out of running 10 or 12. And so I don't have to do quite as much the quantity as I used to. And I have other things that are important in my life. And a lot of it comes down to priorities. But I still really enjoy doing all these things. And, you know, my goals have just shifted where I want to maintain enough fitness to be able to go out and do that 15-mile run in the mountains that I love to do and do that without hurting myself. But maybe I'm not doing marathons all the time and doing
this kid grew up with me. I know his brain. I am not surprised he's doing this actually. He's a very driven kid. You know, he's 27. So, you know, and I think also young age and who knows. But so I thought, well, he sounds exactly like the personality that would train very hard and want to achieve a bigger and bigger goal. I do want to ask, you didn't bring it up in the book because the book's probably in publication, as this woman who ran like 238 miles, do you know, in England, and she was nursing a baby and she broke the record by a huge amount. Oh, what was her name? Oh. I can't even imagine running that far.
I did hear about that. She was running an ultra marathon while nursing.
Yes.
Stopping at some of the,
And so she had to express milk, but also the fact that she beat the previous record by like some crazy number of hours, like 15 hours.
Wow.
You know, so like the previous was 96 and she did it in 83.
Is there a record for fastest ultra marathon time while nursing? It's not the same.
Well, there's
not the same, is it, as the fastest time in a marathon while dressed as a superhero, right?
Right.
I was a little astounded by that.
I was sort of excited that I was able to include in the book both Camille Heron, who is the world record holder for running a marathon dressed as a superhero.
Yes.
Spider-Man. But also Mike Wardian, who holds the record for fastest marathon while dressed as Elvis, which of course he did in Las Vegas. So
that's all you need to do. You could be slow, but do something unique.
Exactly.
You know, you're wearing a bunny suit in the 100 degree heat, but you finished in 6 hours. Still, I am the fastest marathon runner.
Right. And I'll just say that both of those runners are quite fast. But yeah, it's interesting to see what some of the records are these days.
that's certainly true.
Yeah,
I remember several years ago, and I don't know when this came into sort of common knowledge, like to not use over-the-counter painkiller because that actually. So this we can talk about.
Yeah.
Dampening the inflammation mechanism of our body is actually deleterious to recovery.
Right.
So things like taking over-the-counter pills is not a good idea. Maybe icing is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you elaborate on that? Because that did take a portion of the book.
Yeah, so I found that a lot of the products and modalities that are promoted for recovery, one of the big sells here is, it's going to reduce inflammation. But it turns out that inflammation is actually your friend. I mean, inflammation is part of the healing process, and it's a necessary part if you are wanting to get fitter and faster and stronger and make all these adaptations that bodies make in response to exercise. That requires the inflammatory process. And so you have these inflammatory agents coming in. That's part of what's responsible for strengthening your muscles, say, and improving endurance and all of these things that we want to get out of exercise. And so the idea that you want to reduce inflammation is, it turns out, is kind of misguided in a lot of cases. And so it's very common, particularly among ultra marathon runners, but for a lot of runners and endurance athletes in general, to take things like NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen. These are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, prophylactically. So they're taking them not because, you know, these are great painkillers. And there's, you know, if you're in a lot of pain, they're definitely a good thing to take. And I wouldn't advise someone to not do it, you know, because they have a headache or something like that. But the problem here is that people are taking them sort of in anticipation. And so the idea is like, well, I know that this is going to be a hard workout. I'm going to get sore. I'm going to feel bad. And so I'm going to take this in advance and that will reduce my soreness and make me feel better. Well, it turns out that there's actually no good evidence that these things like ibuprofen and other NSAIDs actually reduce soreness or anything like that. So that's the first part. But then they also, by reducing some of this inflammation at the site of the damage and all of that, they can actually impair healing. And so this is also true for like minor orthopedic injuries. It's been shown that these things can actually increase healing time a little bit. And so this does not mean, I mean, you should not make decisions about these things without consulting your doctors. And there's a lot of situations, you know, the takeaway here is not to stop using these drugs, but to be very careful about when they're using them and to not use them thoughtlessly, that they just shouldn't be. I mean, among runners sometimes, ibuprofen is called vitamin I, and that's like absolutely the wrong way to think about it. You don't take it, you know, in anticipation. You take it in response to like serious pain that, you know, is not tolerable without the drugs.
Right. And, you know, so many years ago, I was teaching a segment of my cell biology class, and we sidled into pathology, and I was talking about this inflammation response. And I said, well, and this is where ibuprofen works, and this is, one of my students just raised his hands, and we're talking, this is the early 90s. They were intuitive enough to go, wait, so we need that, but then why are we taking drugs that sort of stop? I said, that's an excellent question. And I said, I don't know the answer why they say, hey, take this, you know, because it was clear, you know, when you see the molecular pathway laid out in front of you and you block it.
Christy has the answer. It's the fear of missing out.
Underlies
an awful lot of this, and I think most people know it one way or another.
I did laugh when I saw FOMO in the book. I thought, you couldn't have written that like even 5 years ago.
Right. Yeah.
We didn't, it wasn't in our lexicon yet.
Exactly. But it's interesting because I think you hit an important point though, and that is that sort of some of this stuff and some of our ideas here sort of miss the basic biology. And like this goes back to hydration and this idea that like, oh my gosh, we have to, there's this advice that's given to athletes that they should, you know, particularly someone running a marathon, say that you weigh yourself before and after and you need to replenish all of those liquids, that any water weight that you're losing or any weight that you're losing during that event needs to be made up for by drinking. And that's just nonsense. I mean, if you look at the biology here and the basic physiology, our bodies are actually very well adapted to fluid loss, particularly during exercise. And so you actually don't need to replace every drop that you're sweating out. And in fact, if you are replacing every drop, you are probably overhydrating. And that's, so the latest guidelines, and there are actually some new scientifically based guidelines for ultra marathoners that are worth looking up if you're interested in this, that actually say drink to thirst and don't, if you are, you know, expect to be losing some weight during this ultra marathon. If you're not, you're overhydrating and that can be dangerous. I mean, it can be deadly. But, you know, there's this all stems from this notion that, you know, our bodies are these precarious things that can't cope with normal life. And it's like, wait a second, how all of a sudden we're in the scientific age and did our bodies stop being able to function? I mean, our ancestors didn't have Gatorade and they didn't have scientists standing by with a hydration chart and, and all of that, you know? Well, so, and this goes back, they think, well, okay, so maybe that's true, but if you just drink a little, you know, if you drink according to our chart, it's more optimal. But like our bodies can cope and your body is capable. There's this whole, it's a very finely tuned feedback mechanism for maintaining that water balance. And, you know, what's important is what's happening in your serum and inside your body internally, it's not so important what's happening in your urine. I mean, having clear urine is just a sign that you're drinking way more water than your body needs. And so it's getting rid of it. And that's, you know, and if that's on the morning of an event, that's probably not a great thing because it means that you're spending most of the morning in the porta potty, you know, instead of warming up.
I got to see that. I could not believe, you know, it's like there's this line of porta potties before the start of the race and every ultra marathoner is lined up. Wow, what a sight. It was an experience for sure. Speaking of messing up the, you know, the biology and the physiology, the explanation of the guy running the cryo tank. Oh my gosh. How the body works.
Right. Yeah. Super oxygenate your blood. It's like
there, somehow.
There's a good point for something that I've been thinking about just now as we were talking about FOMO and how easy it is to be drawn in by pseudoscientific claims and things. And wondering, you've provided us a few ways perhaps to detect those. And so I was wondering about that when you were visiting the infrared sauna. Yeah. My little alarms went off when the fellow explained that it penetrated the skin into the soft tissue, which reminded me of a time I was on a cruise ship and we had a spa tour and one of the ladies there with a, you know, a big name on her badge or something and a mysterious Scandinavian accent explained that this sort of massage they did penetrated not only to the third level, but all the way to the fifth level. And that really convinced me and listening to the cryo guy and, you know, how it draws the blood into the core where it can be super oxygenated. And I think just before you got to saying, what a bunch of bunk, I'm saying, what a bunch of bunk. It doesn't work that way. how do you recognize these things? That, you know, the FOMO leads you to just like, oh, but it sounds good. I need that extra edge. I need something, you know. And the other thing that we've mentioned already is understanding a little more about science gives you a little more confidence to say, my body knows, it says I'm thirsty, I'll drink then. How can people guard against this? Is there anything to do except learn a little more science?
I mean, I think there's a really basic thing, and this is like, your parents probably taught you this. It's like, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Like, has yet to identify actual magic. And so, you know, to the extent that there is magic with recovery, it's sleep, and you already know to do that, you're probably not doing it well. So like, focus on that. I was actually really worried that, you know, people would sort of be turned off by the book because so much of it is debunking, although there's so much that I also am saying works and here's why. And again, I think it's really more about science and how do we know things and how do we know what's true? But I've been receiving, it's been really gratifying, actually. I have received so many letters and tweets and messages from people saying, oh my God, thank you so much. Your book has eased, like people have this anxiety and reading the book, I've heard from so many people, has sort of given them license and made them sort of feel self-assured that they don't have to worry. Like all the stuff that they're sort of being marketed and these worries that they're being told
money on
have,
and time
like
and
permission to not worry about it. And that's seen as a huge relief to a lot of people. So that's been really gratifying because I wasn't sure, you know, if people would feel that way or not. There's another, so there, in terms of recovery itself though, I will say there's one thing that kept coming up again and again, that's a red flag, and that is lactic acid. So lactic acid is something, it is produced in your muscles during hard exercise, you know, during intense exercise, your muscles produce this, but it is not what makes you sore. We used to think that, but now it's very well established that it's not the thing that makes you sore. And in fact, your body can sometimes use it as a source of fuel. So it may in fact be a good thing. But the other important takeaway here is that your body actually clears this very quickly on its own. And so there are all these things that are marketed at people that are like clearing lactic acid, flushing lactic acid. And yeah, that's kind of a red flag that this is nonsense because, you know, first of all, the lactic acid is not going to be what's making you sore, but also chances are by the time you are able to use one of these things, that lactic acid is already gone. So like that was a claim that was like, okay, if you see that, you know that there's some nonsense going on here.
You think we can see some hope in that though? If people talking about this are talking about lactic acid and trying to understand it, okay, we understand that better now and that's wrong. But does it give us some hope that they're thirsty for honest scientific explanations that they can use to understand things and help them do the right thing?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think people are eager for science. And part of the reason, you know, part of the reason that marketers are turning to science to sell their products is that people are eager for science. And we also, I mean, I think it's also a sign that people believe science. And I kind of don't like saying that, like, believe science, because it's not something, it's not a faith to believe in. But I think what I mean is that, you know, people admire, or they sort of understand that science is a powerful way of understanding things and deciding what is true and what works. And so I think that that's part of the reason that this is, you know, so much of this, these marketing claims, is that people are vulnerable to science, and in a good way. You know, it's good that people trust science, and maybe trust is the word I'm looking for. And so people trust science, but that trust is sort of being exploited by, you know, forces who have something to sell, right?
And only use some tenuous science or some science-sounding words. Well, yeah, like that.
That's my blurb for the book, then, is that you showed us that really well about what science has to say, how it can say, and how it's part of this process and is not a mystery, that is something that people, mere people, can't work with.
Yeah, no, I think one of the takeaways too is that the public is very capable of understanding this stuff. And I think that, you know, science communicators and journalists and scientists themselves even, you know, are sometimes guilty of not communicating well about science and sort of overstating things. Like, I think it would be very helpful for the public to understand to a greater extent that how uncertainty is part of the process, how, mm-hmm. you know, scientific answers are not bulletproof, that, you know, every answer is just sort of the latest iteration, and that we must, you know, to have a scientific mindset, that means being always open to new evidence. And so mm-hmm. there are no final answers. And I think that's one of the problems here, is that we have this attitude that science provides finality and it provides assuredness to an extent that it doesn't. And this also makes us very vulnerable, not just to bunk stuff and pseudoscience, but it also makes us vulnerable to vested interests who would like to dismiss good science by mm-hmm. Overstating uncertainty or exploiting uncertainty. I wrote a story for 538 about this, that the title was something like, there's no such thing as sound science. And so there's this concept now that's being mm-hmm. Promoted by, you know, special interests, that, you know, the only good science is sound science, that if there's any uncertainty, then the science isn't settled and we don't know anything. And that's just not how science works. Yeah. But as long as the public believes that that's how science works and believes that good science provides certainty, that's just sort of playing into the hands of the doubt makers who can exploit that doubt. I mean, the classic case of this, right, is the tobacco industry.
Yes.
That's also something we've seen in industries that are pushing back about climate change and global warming. And so, you know, there's almost a playbook now of mm-hmm. how this can be exploited.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't see, right away, you write a lot about science. So did you do some university or college training in science?
Yeah, I have a biology degree. And I had intended to become a scientist until I realized that doing science was kind of boring and tedious.
it can be, and you have to chase money, and
but also, more than that, I'm really a generalist rather than a specialist.
I recognize
that very early. And actually, I think the number one reason I did not become a scientist is I could never decide on what to get my PhD in. And I actually spent a couple of years after college working as a full-time researcher in various labs, trying to like home in on that thing that I wanted to study. And the problem was,
tiny molecule do you want to chase for the rest of your life?
Exactly. And like, I realized, oh my God, if I have to get a PhD in something that small, I couldn't leave all my other interests behind.
I sure identify with that.
Yeah. And that's how I ended up leaving research and going to education, because you're so boxed in.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for that, the way current academia is. So
yeah.
Anyway, we are in our last minute. Is there anything else you wanted to add that maybe we forgot to ask?
I think we've really covered it.
And I think she's asked a great question. Great job summarizing the science and the role of science and all of this. And I love books like this that take something that's of interest to people who may not usually look to science, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. here it is. And they're, you know, it's It was so good. Important. So readable.
Oh, thank you.
An important job, Christy, and you did it well.
Oh, thank you so much.
So glad. And so you had said maybe you'll write another book. So we will keep our eye out.
Yeah.
For this.
Stay tuned. Yeah.
And so good luck with your future ventures. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us as we were talking to Christy Eshwandan about her book, Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. And it's highly readable. I recommend it. It was good, even though I'm just sort of a exerciser to keep myself healthy, right? Mm-hmm. Not an athlete by any stretch. So Christy, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, see you guys.
Christy.
See you next time.
Bye.